Serve It Cold, Episode 3. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Shirley, it's Helen. I know it's early, but I just had to know what else you've heard about Narlene Moore. Nothing? What you mean nothing? Why'd she skip church after umpteen years? What is going on with her? I will not ask Goat Johnson anything. I'm not going into that cradle bar of his that sells beer and who knows what else. Well, I heard there is drugs involved in all this, and that Johnny knows something. On account of him going off into the woods by himself? Hogwallow. Grown man don't spend his time looking at no birds. I don't believe it. And I heard there's someone over to the university that's involved in it now somehow. I don't know how. That's why I'm calling you. I know you sit on your sister's front porch and watch that mini-mart. What is going on there? Yeah. Right. Well, watching Homer Blue cruise the parking lot ain't gonna tell us nothing. That boy's not gonna amount to much, I fear. I know he's a child of God, Shirley. You just keep your eyes on that speed. That's where the real action is. That boy is gonna get himself in trouble again. Mark my words. Oops, here comes the UPS man. I gotta go. Watch speed.
When dawn broke Monday morning, I was sitting in a clump of azaleas in fashionable West Catherine, sipping on a tall cup of Ethiopian Yirgacheffe and thinking about Big John Turner. Big John Turner was the guy who let me tag along behind him while he worked. He's the guy who taught me to drink good coffee when you can, to get sleep when you can, to go without if you must, and to be on the job before your target has even thought about crawling out of bed. Turner taught me how to at least pretend to be a real detective. Every day I worked with Big John, he would say, "Creedmoor, there are three basic rules of investigation." But every day the rules would be different. When I pointed that fact out one day, he spat a stream of foul fast food coffee toward my feet and asked, "And how's that just exactly like life, Creedmoor?" One day, rule number one was, "Don't ever trust a client who won't write you a check." Of course, the same day, rule number two was, "Don't ever take a check. Get folding money and get it up front." I don't remember what rule three was that day, but it should have been, "Don't ever trust a client who won't meet you face to face." That's why my azalea blind was across the street from Dr. Landis Grantham's house instead of Latimer's. I just didn't trust Landis Grantham. As soon as it was light enough to read, I looked over the dossiers that my crack research team, also known as Vera, Gojo, and Lurker 76, had put together on the key players. The brothers were not twins, but they looked twinish and were very close in age. Landis was the elder by 11 months. Both were currently 52. They had been raised on a prosperous farm in Collins, just north of Catherine. They roomed together through college right here at UMAC, the University of Mississippi at Catherine, before going their separate ways for graduate school. Landis got his PhD from the University of Texas, Austin. Landis was a respected professor in geology, but not well liked. He was considered too formal and aloof. No surprise there. I'd done some soft time as a student in the geology department, but I couldn't remember Dr. Grantham at all. Of course, he was a petroleum specialist, while I liked to play with the hard rocks and fossils in those days. Although he had taught quietly at the UMAC for almost 15 years, Landis was now considered a rising star and the major force behind the new Callum Rush Petroleum Institute on campus. He had just been named director of the institute a month before. Vera and I had done some brainstorming over our Sunday night steaks and had decided that if an affair could actually cost the job of a tenured professor, it would have to involve an underage student, a superior's wife, a superior's husband, or Trixie the Wonder Dog. In other words, it would have to be close to his job. But none of my old geology department friends had seen any evidence of an affair. None of them had heard that his wife had moved out of the house, either. Landis Grantham played his personal life close to the vest. At 7 o'clock sharp, Landis, wearing his wedding ring and a scowl, left the house alone and drove off in the only car in the garage, a well-kept but aging black Volvo sedan, an S80. Seeing him jogged my memory just a bit. He was familiar to me, but then it's a small town. He was the very image of a successful university professor, right down to the leather elbow patches on his tweed jacket, his graying hair and short goatee. I sat still for 5 minutes, wondering how Landis would survive a hot fall day dressed in wool, but there was no sign of a tail. Maybe his wife's PI was sleeping in. I caught up with Landis at Pop's, his habitual breakfast diner. I pulled into the parking lot of the competition, Mom's, across the street, and watched Dr. Landis Grantham eat his breakfast alone, pay his bill, and drive onto the UMAC campus. I followed, perfunctorily, but I was already getting bored with this game. It was time to change dossiers. Lillian Banks Grantham, Lily, to everyone but her husband, was 15 years younger than Landis. They'd been married for 6 years. The marriage was his first, her second. She was also from north of Catherine, the small town of Seminary. Lily had been working as a secretary at the university when they married, but in the music department, not geology. She quit work as soon as they married, but still took the occasional class at UMAC. She had come to the university as a theater student, but ended up with a baccalaureate degrees in math and political science and an MBA in international business. All of her degrees were from UMAC. I was familiar with Lily Banks, a fellow perennial student and still an occasional cast member in UMAC plays. As we say down here, I knew her to look at her, and I remembered the looking to be quite a pleasure. She was a satisfying blend of smooth curves, blonde hair, and expensive clothes, who always seemed pissed off at something or someone. Her name had stuck in my mind. It reminded me of the Lady Banks Rose, especially since her hair had the same soft yellow glow that the Lady Banks carries. I found her at the address supplied by Landis. The Blue Pines Apartments sit right across the street from the UMAC campus and border the university's baseball field. I guess that there are plenty of students living in the Blue Pines, but I know for a fact that the complex has long been a favorite transition housing for the newly separated. I had already worked here at least 4 or 5 times before Lily moved in. The place was ideal for surveillance. I simply pulled my invisibility machine, a 10-year-old faded blue Dodge Caravan, into the baseball field parking lot and started snapping pictures through the tinted windows. It was long range, but my trusty field scope bridged the distance. She was dressed Lily casual. Skin-tight jeans, scoop-neck white t-shirt that showed 3 inches of bare midriff. Her hair, now red instead of blonde, was tied out of her face by a twist of bandana. Of course, the bandana, the loose belt at her waist, her fingernails, toenails, and her platform sandals all matched. It was a color that had been called teal in my 264 colors box of Crayolas, but was now probably called something like Bahia Honda Sleepy Dawn. I guess the hair was to match the car, but it just spoiled my whole Lady Lily Banks Rose fantasy. There was no furniture to be seen through the open door of the apartment. No surprise, this was temporary quarters. After she had emptied the jag, Lily pulled a box back out of the apartment, sat on the box, and lit up a cigarette. She smoked. There went that daydream. I had snapped off a couple of shots of her ignoring the Surgeon General's warnings when I saw the Catherine police car turning into the parking lot behind me. I dropped my camera and scope into my war bag and picked up my binoculars. I got out of the van and walked around the front of it, eyes scanning the last few pines that had given the apartment complex its name. Then I noticed the police car. I walked over and found B&E inside. Eaton spoke first.
What the hell are you doing over here, Speed? You can't find anybody to buy your drugs in Crosstown?
I was about to ask you a similar question, Officer Barton. I thought that you were supposed to be Crosstown's neighborhood response team. Have you already stamped out all the crime down there and decided to come show the campus police up? or are you just visiting?" Eaton somehow made his face look even more puckered up than usual. It was Butch that answered.
"Speedy, you know it could be that Eaton and I were following up on a lead concerning a known drug dealer parked right on school property. Don't you think UMAC would qualify as a school under Mississippi law, Eaton?"
Eaton perked up.
"Damn right, Butch. We could search that van right now, Speed, and throw your sorry ass in jail for 30 years without parole."
I worked on sounding nonchalant, while my mind was busily inventorying everything in the van. "Be my guest. Eaton, why don't you go on down to the courthouse and wait for Judge Harless to come in and sign your search warrant? Butch can stay here and watch me so I don't make a break for the border. Butch, I've got some good coffee and a spare pair of binoculars. We can drink coffee and watch birds." Eaton jumped in.
"You're not looking at birds. What kind of freak would go to a ballpark to find birds?"
"You'd be surprised. There are birds everywhere. Right now I'm looking for a bird that can only be found right here, the Eurasian collared dove. It's a big thing, about twice the size of a mourning dove, and hoots like an owl."
"Now you're just making things up, Speed."
Right on cue, a big mailed collared dove parachuted out of the top of a pine tree and glided down onto the parking lot. Landing, it fluffed its feathers, making it look even bigger, and gave the hollow, "Who cooks? You!" call of the species. Eaton's mouth hung open, while Butch huddled over the steering wheel, trying not to laugh out loud. Eaton nudged his partner and said,
"Butch, that damn thing's as big as a chicken!"
Butch lost his battle for composure and exploded with convulsive laughs. I walked over to my van and pulled my thermos out of the front seat. Butch was calming down by the time I got back, and Eaton was wearing his trademark look, a fixed glare that seemed puzzled and belligerent at the same time. Butch saw me coming and held his coffee mug out toward me.
"Is that Sumatra stuff you had yesterday?"
"No, Yirgacheffe. Some say it's the best in the world."
"You said that about the Sumatra."
"Well, I think the Sumatra is the best. But unfortunately, the rest of the world is not yet ready to acquiesce to my superior taste and intellect." After I poured Butch's coffee, I looked to Eaton. He shook his head.
"I don't see what's the matter with plain old American coffee instead of this foreign stuff of yours."
Butch started sniggering again. I said, "Eaton, I don't know about you, but I can't afford American coffee. That Hawaiian and Puerto Rican coffee can cost you $30-$40 a pound."
"You know what I mean. Folgers, Louisiane, CDM, regular American coffee."
"Damn, Speedy. This is good coffee. But we do need to talk with you. I want to know how it is that you managed to forget that the young woman who accused you of stealing her drugs was Narlene Moore."
"Narlene Moore. So that's Narlene Moore? Sure, I've heard of Narlene Moore. She was Miss UMAC this year, wasn't she? And I've heard she's a great basketball player, track star too, but nobody's introduced us." "Well, I'll be beat. That was Narlene Moore. Well, she is a beautiful young lady. I don't think she likes me right now." Butch gave me a sidelong look that could only be described as askance.
"So, Speedy, if you didn't know Narlene Moore when she stood before you and called you a drug thief, why is it that you later showed up at the Cradle Bar, which is owned by Miss Moore's brother?"
"Goat? Goat Johnson is Narlene Moore's brother. It's a small world after all, isn't it? You know, they say that there are really only 40 people in Catherine. We all just move around so much we look like 40,000. I wonder what the other 37 are doing today."
"And can you tell me why Gojo Jackson was working Sunday afternoon dressed in a suit? Don't you usually work Sunday afternoon, Speedy?"
"Damn, Butch. Do you happen to know what wine I had at supper last night? I really liked it, but I've forgotten the vineyard's name." He gave that askance look again, this time with a little bit of impatience mixed in, but was silent. "Look, guys, it's fall migration time. I asked Gojo to watch the store so I could bird some of the trace. Had a good time. In fact, I saw a worm-eating warbler." Eaton guffawed at the bird's name.
"I won't bother asking whether or not you know a Cajun named Sonny Richard. I just want to let you know that we are paying attention, Speedy. Don't go and do something even more stupid than usual. I would really miss your coffee."
He turned to Ellis.
"Look, Knothead. If you want any of this coffee, you get it from Speedy right now. I'm not giving you any of mine.
Well, just a taste wouldn't hurt, I guess.
I soon tired of watching Lily Banks Grantham smoke and Eurasian collared doves chase each other around the ballpark, so I drove by Crystal and bought a big sack of little cheeseburgers on my way to Vera's store, the university mini-mart. Her relief guy, George, took care of the register, while we leaned back in the office, watching the highlight tape of the year's crop of Alpha Sig pledges, trying to emulate the exploits of the great UMAC Alpha Sig hero, Jimmy Buffett, as revealed in his song Peanut Butter Conspiracy. Every year they came with the task of shoplifting peanut butter and sardines, and every year, Gigi would have the store manager put the sardines behind the register and the peanut butter in a display on the register. It was always an exercise in futility on everyone's part. The pledges never got both items. The peanut display was crashed regularly, as desperate grab-and-go maneuvers sprayed peanut butter jars across the floor, and drunk, frustrated freshmen usually managed to grab something often more valuable than the sardines. But on the positive side, Jimmy had already written the perfect soundtrack to my yearly tribute to shoplifting. It was a good time. Little cheeseburgers, the woman I love laughing at my funny movie, money in my pocket with promise of more on the way. The future was as bright as a September dawn. So it goes, running up and down the aisles of the mini-mart, sticking food in our jeans. I left Vera's store with less than a dozen little cheeseburgers left in my bag for Gojo, and a list of more than a dozen things I had promised Vera that I would take care of before leaving town in the morning. At Crosstown, I parked away from the front door in the shade of an old water oak. September in Mississippi doesn't really mean that summer is over. The temperature was hovering in the mid-90s. As I approached the store, Bebop left the bench and met me.
Blackbeard, you better not park that raggedy piece of junk of yours down there. Little Man's done declared war on you.
Homer?
Yeah, Little Man Homer. He's saying he's gonna cap your ass, Beard. And you want to know why? Just take a damn good guess.
Well, could it possibly be that he's saying I stole some pot from him? Bebop opened his eyes in mock surprise.
Whoa, Beard! You turned pure psychic on us! I'll be your pimp and get you a 1-900 number for sure. Get you a headband and some dreads. Be richer than the mayor.
He drew closer and his voice lowered.
Frail Blackbeard? I don't sell little Debbies. Why the hell you want to go get up in my business?
I'm not selling drugs of any kind, but here's a heads up. B&E are actually looking into this thing, and Bebop, they know a lot more than they should. Somebody's talking. It's not me, it's not Gojo, I don't think it's you. I turned and looked at the Amen bench. Bebop followed my eyes with his to the bench and nodded.
Check, Beard.
I held the bag out open toward him. Cheeseburger? He looked at the big red crystal printed across the front and shook his head.
No thanks, Beard. I only partake of the Black Angus beef.
He turned back to the bench, and I went to move my car. Inside, Gojo was prioritizing my messages.
Vera says give her a call if you get here before lunch.
I tossed the bag toward him, and he continued.
I guess that means no need. Okay, Mr. Goat Johnson says to come see him pronto. It's important. Lurker says he's finished with his queue and sent you email on 5 fines.
Great. So Lurker's actually talking to you now.
Well, sort of. He doesn't just grunt and hang up when I answer now.
Gojo, will you make the phone calls on the 5 traces? I'll split my take with you. If we need to make any contacts, tell him I'll be available early next week. And have you talked to George about helping you cover the store this week? I just saw him at Vera's store, but I didn't think to talk to him.
Okay, see, just calm down a minute. I'll take care of the traces, and I'll get George to spell me, but I haven't finished with the messages.
I took a deep breath and nodded. He resumed his list.
Gigi wants to know why I'm answering the phone and where the hell you are. And somehow I got the notion that Mr. Castor still thinks I'm a janitor.
Hell, Gojo, at least he remembers that you work here. I'll get Vera to call Gigi. She's the only one who can calm the beast. Is that all?
Well, there's one more thing. Homer says he's going to kill you. And he's been hiding in the bushes, shooting the front windows with a BB gun all morning.
All I can tell you is call the cops if he manages to break something. The glass company's phone number is in the logbook. We've got an account. I'm out of here until this case is over. Listen, Gojo, don't work till you drop, and for God's sake, don't fall behind on your classes. George will be happy to catch some extra hours.
Yo, who's lecturing who, Mr. Big Shot Detective? You don't got Big John Turner backing you up anymore, see? You be real careful.
Okay, Mama, I'll be careful. This should be pretty routine, though. I'm expecting to get all the evidence I need tonight. Then I'm just going to take a little Big Easy vacation on Dr. Grantham. Gojo lowered his voice in a weak impression of Big John's gravelly bass.
Creemore, the number one rule of investigation is that there just ain't no such thing as a routine investigation.
As I left, my eyes were watering, so that I almost didn't notice the BB bounce off my car door as I got in.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com.